When someone you love is facing cancer, you want to do more than send a card or flowers that will wilt in a week. You want to actually help. That's where the Balm Box comes in. Our care packages are built from research with over 500 cancer patients and caregivers, packed with items people actually use during treatment. Think soothing, practical, thank goodness I have this kind of relief. For you, it's not just a gift. It's a way to show up in a moment where words fall short. For them, it's comfort, calm, and a reminder they're not alone. From chemo-friendly boxes to mastectomy recovery kits, even options for men, we've made it simple to give something that's elegant, premium, and genuinely useful. And yes, domestic shipping's always free on orders over $50, because making someone feel cared for shouldn't be complicated. So skip the empty get well soon. Send real help, real comfort, and maybe even a laugh. Visit thebalmbox.com. That's thebalmbox.com. Balm, like healing and care. The Balm Box. Because cancer patients don't need bouquets and brownies. They need Balm.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly. In January of 2023, a 46-year-old man in Beach City, Texas, went to bed next to his wife and never woke up. His family was told that it was a stroke. The obituary blamed complications from his diabetes, but when doctors saw how his blood sugar kept crashing, and when detectives pulled his wife's history, they didn't just see a medical mystery. They saw four ex-husbands, a dead fiance, a trail of fires, and one woman at the center of it all. This is the story of Sarah Jean Hartsfield. By January of 2023, 46-year-old Joseph Anthony Hartsfield was lying in a Baytown, Texas ICU, unresponsive. His wife, Sarah, told people that he'd had a stroke. She told others it was complications from his diabetes. His obituary would later repeat that he died from complications of an ischemic stroke with his loving wife by his side. But doctors weren't convinced. Every time they pushed his blood sugar up, something was dragging it back down. Within weeks, investigators would learn that there was a lot more going on in Sarah Jean Hartsfield's life than a tragic medical event, and that Joseph was just the last in a long line of men who thought they might not survive loving her. Now, Sarah's story starts in rural Missouri. She grew up in a small town in a house that never really looked stable from the outside. Her stepfather had done time for murder years before she was born, convicted in the 70s for killing a man in what was described as a jealous love triangle shooting. He was then paroled in the 80s. When Sarah was still young, her little brother died in what officials at the time called a bizarre accident in the home. There were questions about how it happened and about how oddly unemotional the children's mother seemed after the fact. Apparently, her little brother was 10 years old at the time, and he was allegedly playing with a nylon dog leash on the front porch of the family home when he fell off of it, and then the leash got caught on a stair railing. So the mother ended up finding him face down with the leash around his neck. He unfortunately was dead upon arrival at a hospital in Sedalia, Missouri. Investigators ruled it as an accidental death, but acknowledged the bizarre nature of it in their documents. Later, Sarah's biological father would die too, in a way that wouldn't raise many public eyebrows until decades down the line when investigators started pulling every file with Sarah's name on it. Now, apparently there were allegations against her biological dad. Multiple people who knew Sarah told investigators that the trauma from her childhood involved sexual abuse allegations that she made against both her biological father and her stepfather. So she was eventually sent to live with a foster family with at least one of her brothers. And one of the women that took her in was named Barb. And Barb would later describe two very different versions of Sarah. There was the quiet, polite teenager who arrived, and then the older teenager who eventually emerged, who was sneaky and manipulative and quick to turn people against each other. Barb would eventually watch Sarah become a mother herself and say that she was harsh and punishing with her own kids, more focused on control than actual motherly care. When Sarah's name hit the news in connection with Joseph's death, Barb said she was not surprised at all. By 18, Sarah was out of foster care and on her own. She met a boy named Titus Norschild in high school. And like plenty of teenagers dying to get out of the house, she went straight from childhood into marriage. Titus joined the army, and Sarah followed that path as well. The two of them ended up as very young soldiers, eventually stationed at Fort Hood in Texas, married and trying to build a life together. Titus would later say that those years didn't feel like young love so much as they did a minefield. He described Sarah as verbally and emotionally abusive, controlling, and quick to go for the jugular in arguments. He carried something else around too, which was a huge life insurance policy through the Army worth about $200,000 with Sarah as the beneficiary. So looking back, he said that he was genuinely afraid that he might not make it out of the marriage alive, that the policy felt less like protection and more like a target on his back. The marriage collapsed after only a couple of years. Reportedly, Sarah started messing around with one of their fellow army buddies, a man named Michael Traxler. So Titus and Sarah divorced. Now, for most people, that would be where the story ends. But for Titus, it wasn't. Sometime after the breakup, he was staying at a friend's trailer with his new girlfriend, Angela. It was late, the kind of dead quiet time of night when you wake up if something feels off. Well, Angela woke up and noticed that something was definitely wrong. She smelled gasoline. She stepped outside and saw a figure running away from the trailer. She later testified that she recognized the person immediately. It was Sarah. Gasoline was found around and on the trailer. No one died, no one was physically hurt, and no one was charged. This incident went down as one of those frightening near misses that just doesn't really go anywhere in the court system. Titus just moved on with his own life, always keeping one eye open and over his shoulder. Years later, when reporters called him to tell him that Sarah had been arrested for murder, he said two things. He was glad she'd finally been caught for who she really was, and he was sorry that someone had to die first. By then, she'd already left a second marriage behind, too. Now, I mentioned a moment ago that after Titus, she married another soldier named Michael. Well, that relationship was short and ugly. Court records show that in March of 1996, Houston police arrested Sarah and charged her with assault causing bodily injury after an argument with Michael. The case was dropped a week later. There was no conviction, and he's kept a very low profile since. But on paper, it's an early documented moment where a partner called the police and said that her anger had crossed the line. Husband number three was Christopher Donahue. Now, Christopher would be the longest and most traditional of her marriages, at least from the outside. They met through the army stationed in Alaska at one point, both of them part of the same world of deployments, PCS moves, and military housing. They married in 1999, settled eventually in Belton, Texas, near Fort Hood, and they had four children together, one son and three daughters. To people who saw them at church or in the neighborhood, they looked like a successful army family. She was a proud soldier and then an army wife, and he was serving and later working. The kids were busy in sports and youth groups. Their house looked like any other house in the subdivision. But inside, the kids tell a very different story. As adults, all four of them would testify that their mother's discipline was not normal discipline. They described beatings with belts, spoons, and shoes, punishments that dragged on for hours, and being kept home from school until their bruises faded. They said Sarah controlled what they wore, what they ate, what they said, and what they were allowed to tell anyone outside of their family. If they tried to confide in someone or pushed back, they say she told them no one would believe them anyway. Their father, Christopher, was often away with the army, and even when he was home, they say that any attempt he made to protect them would just backfire. Their mother would simply redirect her anger towards him. Over time, the marriage rotted from the inside out. In the middle of all that, Sarah built a career of her own in uniform. She joined the Army in the late 90s, starting in transportation and moving into intelligence. She deployed to Baghdad from 2007 to 2008 and eventually rose to the rank of Sergeant First Class. She held a top secret clearance, worked in intel shops, and was trusted to handle very sensitive information. A retired captain who supervised her later described her as smart, efficient, and capable, the kind of NCO who produced good work. But he also said she was volatile enough that he and other officers started documenting every interaction with her and tried to avoid ever being alone with her. She wasn't naive or overwhelmed. She was sharp and, in his eyes, dangerous. As her Army career moved forward, her home life was coming apart. That's around when another man outside the Donahue marriage entered the picture, a boyfriend named Brian. He lived out of state, and they met online and carried on a long-distance relationship that lasted a couple of years. Brian later told reporters that when things were good, they were great, romantic, intense, fun. But if he didn't respond quickly enough to a text, or if he tried to pull back, he said she would blow up his phone on every platform she could reach and lash out in rage. Arguments were intense, and when he finally broke it off, he described the breakup as horrible as it could ever be. Shortly after the relationship ended, Brian was out at a local bar with friends when he got a call from police. His house was on fire. He rushed home to find his bedroom gutted. The official cause was faulty wiring. Nobody ever filed charges, and Sarah was never accused of arson in that case. But the timing certainly stuck with him. When he later learned what had happened to Joseph, he couldn't help but thinking about the night that his house burned. By the mid-2010s, the Donahue marriage was done. Christopher took an overseas posting and moved with their son to South Korea. Sarah stayed in Texas with the three daughters. The divorce would be finalized a few years later, but even before the ink was dry, Sarah was already moving into her next serious relationship. The man's name was David Bragg. He was an Air Force veteran who worked as a mechanic, then as a contractor at Fort Hood. He'd grown up in a big family, one of eight kids, and he was the kind of guy whose siblings say that he filled up a room when he walked in. He was loud, funny, the storyteller at every gathering, the uncle who would get down on the floor and wrestle with the kids. Somewhere along the way, he and Sarah reconnected and started dating, and it got serious pretty quickly. They got engaged. She started using his last name off and on, signing documents as Sarah Bragg or Sarah Donahue, depending on where she was and who she was dealing with. In 2017, she told her children that David had an opportunity in Minnesota, something connected to a solar energy job and a big old farmhouse that needed some work. Within days, the family packed up and moved from Texas to Douglas County, Minnesota, into that rural property near Garfield. It was the kind of house you could imagine fixing up forever. There was lots of space, big potential, and it was in the middle of nowhere. But, of course, a place like that doesn't take long for tensions to surface. Ryan, the oldest child, clashed with David almost from the start. Later, Ryan would tell investigators and reporters that David was physically abusive to him, that he had slammed him into a wall, knocked him down a flight of stairs, and once pointed a rifle at him as he ran down the driveway. One sister said that she overheard at least one of those incidents through the phone. None of that ever resulted in charges, and David can't answer for those allegations now. What is clear is that the farmhouse was a stressful place to live, and that Sarah's relationships with her kids and with David were complicated and volatile. On May 9th of 2018, a 911 call came in from that rural Douglas County house. When deputies arrived, they found David Bragg on the floor, shot multiple times. Sarah told them that she had fired in self-defense. In her version, David had snapped, attacked her, and fired a shot at her on the stairs. She said she grabbed a gun and shot him to stop him. Investigators processed the scene. At least some of the physical evidence, like where a bullet hole was in the house, seemed to line up with her story. So the county attorney's office eventually concluded that under Minnesota law, they didn't have grounds to charge her. So David's death was ruled a justifiable homicide, a case of self-defense. The file was then closed. David's family struggled to accept that. They were told that it was self-defense, that the investigation supported her story, and that this was the end of it. But there were details that really nagged at them. His mother remembered strange comments from Sarah at the funeral, the way that she cried over the casket and said, "Why did you make me do that?" Then she remembered Sarah went back to shopping and talking about moving on. Still, there was nothing they could do. As far as the law was concerned, Sarah had been justified. Within months, another man named David was in the picture. His name was David George. He worked for a gas company in Minnesota. Sometime after the shooting, he and Sarah married. He moved into that same farmhouse where David Bragg had just been murdered. To Bragg's family, it felt like a second invasion, someone else living in their brother's home, as if the whole thing had just been this minor speed bump. Sarah and David George's marriage eventually took them back to Texas, this time again to the Belton area. Some of Sarah's daughters lived with them. Others moved back and forth between parents. Christopher, the third husband, had remarried. His new wife was named Heather, and according to the children, Sarah resented Heather deeply. In 2021, things reached a point where the FBI actually got involved. David George contacted authorities and said that Sarah had been pressuring him to kill Heather. A federal agent later testified that David had traveled to Arizona, where Christopher and Heather were living, under the pretense of delivering flowers to their home. The suggestion was that this delivery was supposed to be a cover for murder. One of Sarah's daughters testified that David told her bluntly, quote, "Your mom wants me to kill your dad's wife," end quote, and that she heard her mother tell David he couldn't come back home until he, quote, "took care of what needed to be done," end quote. Nothing ultimately happened to Heather. David backed out. He cooperated with investigators. The FBI opened a case, but prosecutors never brought murder for hire charges against Sarah or David. It was just another disturbing story that on its own didn't make it into a charging document. But for her, it's almost like she's this cat with nine lives. She just keeps getting all these second chances. But later, when Texas prosecutors stood in front of a jury, they would use that alleged plot as part of a pattern. People around Sarah getting hurt, threatened, or nearly killed when they wanted out or got in her way. So Sarah filed for divorce from David George in early 2022. Their Belton house was sold and David faded back into a low-profile life. Sarah, by then, had already met the man who would become her fifth husband, Joseph Hartsfield. Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day. And then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's MAMA at secretnature.com. Have you ever felt like no matter how much you rest, you're still just running on empty? Fatigue, brain fog, even brittle nails, those can all be signs of iron deficiency. And here's the thing, iron deficiency is way more common than people realize. It affects about 1 in 3 adults, especially women, and traditional iron supplements usually don't cut it. They're hard to absorb, and they often leave you dealing with nausea, constipation, or a metallic-y taste. That's why I recommend Citerol from PharmaNutra. Citerol is a premium iron supplement made with patented sucrosomial technology, which basically wraps the iron in a protective shield so your body can absorb it 3 to 4 times better than standard iron. And the best part is it's gentle on the stomach. There's no nausea, no constipation, and no metallic taste. Citerol has been clinically studied, over 150 published studies, in fact, and it's trusted by more than 2 million people worldwide. It's Italy's number one supplement brand and is finally available here in the U.S. Just one capsule a day with water anytime, with or without food, and you're good to go. So if you're nodding along because you're exhausted, foggy, or just tired of feeling tired, this could be exactly what you've been missing. Head to pharmanutra-us.com and use the code MAMA, that's M-A-M-A, for 10% off your first order of Citerol. That's pharmanutra-us.com with the code MAMA, M-A-M-A, for 10% off today.
When someone you love is facing cancer, you want to do more than send a card or flowers that will wilt in a week. You want to actually help. That's where the Balm Box comes in. Our care packages are built from research with over 500 cancer patients and caregivers, packed with items people actually use during treatment. Think soothing, practical, thank goodness I have this kind of relief. For you, it's not just a gift. It's a way to show up in a moment where words fall short. For them, it's comfort, calm, and a reminder they're not alone. From chemo-friendly boxes to mastectomy recovery kits, even options for men, we've made it simple to give something that's elegant, premium, and genuinely useful. And yes, domestic shipping's always free on orders over $50, because making someone feel cared for shouldn't be complicated. So skip the empty get well soon. Send real help, real comfort, and maybe even a laugh. Visit thebalmbox.com. That's thebalmbox.com. Balm, like healing and care. The Balm Box. Because cancer patients don't need bouquets and brownies. They need balm.
Joseph Hartsfield was a hometown sort of man. Born in Channel View, just outside of Houston, in 1976, he graduated from C.E. King High School, went on to earn a bachelor's degree in criminal justice, and spent his adult life working, spending time with his kids, hunting, fishing, riding four-wheelers, and being the clown at family gatherings. He did have diabetes, something that everyone around him knew about, and he managed it with insulin, diet, and technology, including a continuous glucose monitor that could actually send alerts to his phone and to his partners if his blood sugar went dangerously high or low. Joseph met Sarah online through Facebook. They started talking, quickly moved into a relationship, and within about 3 months, they were married. On February 2nd of 2022, they said their vows in Huntsville, Texas. Later that year, they bought a house together in Beach City, a small community near Baytown along the coast. Now, for a moment, it probably looked like a fresh start. On social media, Sarah framed Joseph as her soulmate. They had cute couple photos, posts about how happy she was, all the usual online gloss of facade book. Behind that, according to his family and friends, it was another story of constant arguments and rising fear. Relatives say Joseph confided that he and Sarah were fighting all the time, especially over money. He would show up for work hours early just to avoid being in the house. His sister noticed that she kept getting blocked from his phone along with their mother, and Joseph didn't seem to know why he wasn't getting their calls. Clearly, she, Sarah, was probably going in his phone and blocking all these females. But family members later said that more than once, Joseph told them he was afraid his wife might kill him in his sleep. By the first week of January of 2023, he was ready to leave. On January 3rd, he spoke with a family member about moving out of the Beach City house and starting a divorce. They hadn't even been married 1 year. He asked if he could come stay, and the answer was yes. On January 5th, he went back to Huntsville and opened up a new bank account in his own name, something clean and separate from anything he shared with Sarah. It was a clear sign that he wasn't just talking about leaving, he was really preparing to do it. Then he went back home to Beach City. 2 days later, paramedics were carrying him out of the house on a stretcher. According to what Sarah would later tell investigators, the night before Joseph collapsed, she cooked him one of his favorite meals. They ate, they went to bed, and sometime in the night, his blood sugar dropped. She said their phones received alerts from his glucose monitor, but that she thought she could manage it herself, giving him juice, maybe some jam, letting him rest. When she checked on him again the next day, she said he wasn't responding. Phone and app data would eventually tell a more detailed story. Investigators would later testify that the glucose monitor began sending out alarms as Joseph's blood sugar fell into a dangerous range. Logs suggested that Sarah's phone was in use through the night. She was scrolling, opening apps, showing activity almost every hour. At some point, she recorded a video of Joseph in distress, breathing strangely, he was unresponsive, and sent that clip to one of her daughters. The state's timeline put that message out more than an hour before she ever called 911. Now, what's not disputed is that the eventual call for help came late. When paramedics arrived at the Beach City home on January 7th, they found Joseph unresponsive and in bad shape. He was rushed to a nearby hospital and then transferred to an ICU. Doctors threw everything they had at his blood sugar, but he was not waking up. They noticed that no matter how much sugar they gave him, his levels kept crashing the way that they would if someone had overdosed on insulin. After 8 days in a coma on January 15th of 2023, Joseph died. An autopsy later concluded that he died from complications of the toxic effects of insulin. The medical examiner listed the manner of death as undetermined, meaning they couldn't say from a purely medical standpoint whether it was a homicide, suicide, or an accident. To Joseph's family, still believing what they'd been told about a stroke, that detail wouldn't matter for a little while. To the sheriff's office, it mattered a lot. The Chambers County Sheriff's Office had already been alerted by the hospital that this didn't look like a typical diabetic emergency, so detectives started digging. They pulled phone records, text messages, app logs, and data from Joseph's and Sarah's devices. They interviewed Joseph's relatives and coworkers, learning about his plans to leave, the new bank account that he'd opened, and the fear that he had voiced to his family about his wife. When they started running her name, they got callbacks from all over. We're talking Missouri, Texas, Minnesota, Arizona. Ex-husbands, boyfriends, children, foster parents, a former fiance's family. I mean, they had all these stories and they all seemed to end the same way, with someone scared, hurt, or worse. On February 3rd of 2023, 1 day after their first anniversary and less than a month after Joseph's death, a grand jury indicted Sarah Jean Hartsfield for murder. Her bond was set at $5 million. She was arrested and booked into the Chambers County Jail. While she awaited her trial, she sent long messages to a local TV station insisting that she loved Joseph, that she had been doing her best to care for him while recovering from surgery herself, and that she was the victim of lies and character assassination. She said more than once that if she was guilty of anything, it was picking horrible husbands. Her arrest set off a chain reaction in other states as well. In Minnesota, the Douglas County attorney took another shot at the 2018 shooting of David Bragg. The case that had been closed as self-defense was formally reopened and listed as an active investigation. In Missouri, sheriffs reviewed the old case of her younger brother's bizarre childhood death and her biological father's death in 2005. those stayed officially unchanged, still ruled as accidental or natural, but they weren't ignored anymore. All these files now had one thing in common. They either involved or revolved around Sarah. It took more than 2 years for the murder case to reach trial. In the fall of 2025, in a Chambers County courtroom of East Houston, a jury finally heard the story of what the state believed happened to Joseph and what they believed it said about the woman sitting at that defense table. Prosecutors framed Joseph's death as the end of a long pattern. They didn't just put on doctors to talk about insulin or detectives to walk through the phone logs. They called ex-husbands and boyfriends who described a woman who could be charming and fun at first and then suddenly explosive and cruel. Titus told the story of being a teenage soldier, terrified that his wife might kill him for life insurance, and the night that Angela woke up to smell gasoline and saw Sarah running from that trailer that had been doused. Brian described the long-distance relationship, the savage fights, the house fire that destroyed his bedroom shortly after he left her. An FBI agent explained the alleged murder-for-hire plot involving David George and the trip to Arizona under the cover of a flower delivery. Her adult children also took the stand and described growing up under a regime of fear, the beatings, the punishments, the rules about who they could talk to and what they were allowed to tell their dad. They talked about Minnesota, about hearing or seeing parts of what happened around the time of the Bragg shooting, and about conversations later that made them question whether the self-defense story really matched what they had lived through. Joseph's family testified about 2022 and early 2023, about the fights about money, the way he used to come to work early just to get away from the house, the phone blocks that they discovered later, and the conversations where they said that he thought his wife might kill him. Medical experts explained insulin, continuous glucose monitors, and why Joseph's crash looked less like a diabetic miscalculation and more like an overdose. Detectives walked jurors through the timeline of the night Joseph went down. The alarms, the phone activity, the video that was sent to her daughter, and the gap before anyone ever called for help. The defense fought back by focusing on the cracks in the state's case. They reminded the jury that the medical examiner had not ruled Joseph's death a homicide, but rather undetermined. They emphasized that there was no direct evidence of Sarah injecting insulin. There was no eyewitnesses, no confession, no video of her doing it. They argued that all the talk about fires, old deaths, and messy divorces were just designed to make her look like a monster instead of prove what actually happened in that bedroom. Sarah herself did what she'd been doing for months from jail. She maintained that she hadn't murdered her husband, that she loved him, and that his death was a tragic medical event twisted into something sinister by people who already hated her. But medically, it was rock solid that Joseph died from a massive insulin overdose. What they did not have was a smoking gun syringe or pen tying Sarah's hands directly to that dose. So investigators found 8 to 10 insulin pens on Joseph's side of the bed and around the house, but they made what one lieutenant later called a 100% an error because they didn't seize or test those pens. So in closing, her lawyer straight up told the jury, quote, "Joseph administered that insulin to himself, and there is absolutely no proof that Sarah administered insulin," end quote. So in early October of this year, the jurors got the case and weighed all of it. The insulin levels, the phone data, the delay in calling 911, the stories from ex-husbands and children, the reopened files in other states, and her own insistence that she was innocent. And they came back with a verdict: guilty of murder in the death of Joseph Hartfield. In the sentencing phase, the jury heard even more about her past. Her former foster mother described the change that she had seen in Sarah from a damaged kid to a calculating adult. Her children talked about the lasting effects of growing up in that house. Joseph's family spoke about what it meant to lose him, not to a random stroke or a cruel twist of diabetes, but to someone he had chosen to trust and marry. The jury sentenced her to life in prison. Under Texas law, that means she will spend decades behind bars before she can even ask for parole. Given her age, there is a real possibility she will die in prison. Up in Minnesota, the file on David Bragg's death remains open. No new charges have been announced, but the case is no longer considered fully resolved. In Missouri, those early tragedies in her life, including her brother's death and her father's death, have been reexamined and then left as they were, at least for now. No court has found Sarah responsible for any of those deaths, so legally, her conviction is tied to one man, Joseph Hartfield. But when investigators look at her life laid out on a timeline, it doesn't read like one bad act in an otherwise ordinary story. It reads like a pattern, a childhood around violence and unexplained loss, a series of relationships that either ended in fear or flames, a fiancé shot dead in what was once accepted as self-defense, a near-miss murder plot that never quite made it to a charge, and finally a husband whose blood sugar sank in a way his own body could not explain. That is the picture that put Sarah Jean Hartsfield in a Texas prison for life. And that's the picture that still has another state quietly asking whether one more death in her past might not actually be as settled as it once seemed. That's it for today's deep dive. Thank you so much for listening. And if you follow me on socials, I want to make you all aware that I have changed my name on my socials to be True Crime Kelly so that it's a little easier to find and also a little easier for new listeners to realize what it's all about. I felt like Mama Mystery was maybe a little too vague as a screen name. So Mama Mystery will remain the name of my podcast. But if you want to find me on Instagram or Facebook, look up True Crime Kelly. That is it for today. I'll see you later this week for the weekly docket. I have heard that it's all your all's favorite, so I will not be missing it. And until then, stay curious, stay vigilant. Mama Mystery out.